Let's have the discussion. You're listening to Canter with Scott and Adam.
Hello, welcome to Canter. I'm Scott Hillier, and joining me today is Matthew Gates, also known as Sync Angel. Matthew, it's a pleasure having you on the show, mate. We've had a bit of a journey making this one happen. I've had a bit of an indiscretion with our last meeting and got the time zones wrong. And I do apologise for that sincerely, but I'm really happy that you've stuck with us and we've managed to make this happen because you're someone I personally really want to have a chat with. You fascinate me and your content fascinates me. So welcome to the show and thank you for joining us, mate.
Well, thanks for having me, and I really appreciate it. I do find that we'll probably have a lot of cool things to talk about if your other podcasts are an indication.
Cheers, man. I appreciate that feedback as well. Now, Matthew, are you able to tell the listener a little bit about what you do, man? Because you're very specialized, but you're so important to the cannabis industry. So, yeah, could you get into that a little bit, please?
So, absolutely. I am what people call an integrated pest management specialist, which means that I deal with agricultural pests, primarily not household pests, not residential pests, although there is some crossover sometimes. And I try to keep people from having the problems in the first place. And in the cannabis industry, this is particularly important, but not just biological things like insects and mites, but also sort of non-biological things like your environment and sort of controlling your property and the physical barriers you might put up and that sort of a thing. So it's all kind of holistic and interconnected.
Yeah, that's awesome. I like that you talk about the environment as well. It's something I'm going to get into with you in a little bit. Now, you have a heap of content, as I've mentioned. You go by the name Sync Angel on Instagram. For the listeners, spelled S-Y-N-C-H-A-N-G-E-L. And you also put out a heap of content on YouTube under your business name of Xenthanol. Check it out, guys. Matt puts a lot of effort into putting content out there. It's great to have access to free content that goes into such depth. So, I'm really appreciative of what you put out there, Matthew. And I really hope some of you guys at home are going to check his stuff out. Now, Matthew, you are fascinated by insects, quite clearly looking at your content. My six-year-old son is really fascinated with insects and bugs right now, in particular spiders. And I just picture him, he's so cute seeing him run around and track down a spider and bring everyone to have a look. And I just want to talk about your past and your childhood. And I picture perhaps you as a child, as someone similar to my son, that's just, quite sciencey and quite into the bugs and things that maybe scare other children. Is that what you were like as a small child?
I would agree with that description. And I think my parents would too. And when I was very young, around like maybe 1996, 97, it was around that Pokemon craze became really popular here in the United States. And, when I look back on it, I tell people the story sometimes about how the person who made the Pokemon series was exactly as you described your child. He was walking around, going into caves, catching bugs, that kind of a thing. In fact, bug catcher is like a type of trainer in the game or whatever. Okay. So I always thought that was kind of an interesting link, and I think it helped me sort of cement in an imaginary world as well as in the real world, that sort of interest. It allowed me to play in a fantasy world where I catch these bugs or other sorts of things like that. And as a child, I also definitely, I was in the Boy Scouts. I am an Eagle Scout. And so I got a lot of outdoors experience hiking Yosemite Trail, the John Muir Trail. As a 12-year-old or 13-year-old, I went up Half Dome and hiked and summited Mount Whitney. So I've definitely had a lot of outdoors experience as a kid, and I was always looking at like little bugs and plants and things like that.
That's really cool, man. It'd be good for my son to see that there is a future in that field as well. So yeah, thank you for putting this out there. I'm going to ask you a couple of questions on behalf of him later in the podcast.
Absolutely.
So that'll be really cool. You went to the military after you mentioned your scouts time. And then beyond that, you went into the military in your early adulthood. Are you able to tell us a bit about how you got to that point? And then what happened afterwards?
So I actually went to, I participated in a high school military program, or just a junior reserve officer training corps, I guess you could say. So not quite the military just then yet, but I was doing Boy Scouts at the same time, and I was very much considering a military career. I went to the San Diego State University, and I was very interested in their military science program. And I participated in it for 2 years, which is the cutoff time before you have to sign on if you want to become an officer. And in my case, it was the Army ROTC, so a second lieutenant in the Army. And I actually did not pursue that part of the exchange for a couple of different reasons. But basically, I come from a military family. My father was in the Vietnam War, and my maternal grandfather and paternal grandfather were both in World War II. So I thought it would be a natural move. And anyone who knows my content knows that I do take some of that, I guess you could say, perspective about, like, I used in a recent podcast this phrase, threat model of the battle space.
Yeah,
and that cool. Sort of like mentality of like trying to be tactical and strategic, but towards like your own situation. And to be honest, I think that this is not a unique thing in general. People try to find the most efficient way to do things, and the military tends to find ways to do that. You know, no matter what the nationality or group is, it's usually very similar objectives. And so I do have a bit of an objective-based approach to my integrated pest management.
That's cool. That's really cool. You mentioned earlier on the physical aspect of what you do. So I would love to talk about the very basics of someone operating a grow space. And specifically, I'd like to talk about the hygiene and etiquette that they should be using when they're operating a space, whether it be someone operating, you know, 30 plants in their garage under a license or something along those lines, all the way up to a big commercial facility. What are the core, concepts of grow room hygiene and etiquette?
So the first one I would say, perhaps the most important thing you can do is to have some sort of way to protect your crop. Now that sounds very basic, but you know, like creating physical barriers. If you're growing in a commercial location or if you're growing in a residential space, you know, not letting insects and mites and things like get into your house or get into your grow space will eliminate a lot of your problems. Now, in a lot of cases, that can be easier said than done, of course. But if you're cognizant of the fact that like, there might be like, you know, kind of a few centimeters of space between, you know, your front door and the floor, if it's not flush or if there aren't like good seals or connections, even in like tents, then you're allowing things to get in. And in a lot of cases, these insects and small flies and things are going to be attracted to little volatiles in your plant, coming off of your plant, or the moisture content of your soil is going to be an attractive thing. They might be able to kind of sniff out, for lack of a better term. And so if you could do that, that's very important. In addition to that, and this also goes in with the etiquette that you're talking about, and hygiene for that matter, when you take in new plant material, you should always, always quarantine it. You should always put it somewhere else, because even if it's your friend who might, whether they know better or not, they might not have looked over their plant, or they might have gotten some great deal, or they're just adamant and confident they don't have any pests, but they do. In some cases, there aren't any symptoms, or there are very little symptoms. And so people just don't know these symptoms, or they don't even know to look. And in a few cases, like with hoplite and viroid, there is no symptom in the beginning, at least for a lot of people. And so then they send that to somebody else and then it gets to other people. So you should always try to quarantine your plants so that you don't get infected and you also don't spread that to somebody else too. You should always look over your plants.
Just quickly, you mentioned hop latent viroid. It's something that I heard a little bit of a whisper about in a country near to us, a neighbour to Australia, let's say. Now, what's the process of identifying this virus? Because you mentioned that it may not show symptoms early on. How are people able to get onto this disease early and identify it early enough? Because my understanding is that once it does display symptoms, it can perhaps be displaying similar symptoms to a variety of other diseases.
Right, so the name hop latent viroid kind of gives you a bit of a hint. The symptoms are latent. The symptoms kind of happen very later on. So in a lot of ways, there is nothing somebody can tell visually. And the way that people would do so in a commercial setting would be to get it tested in a lab or perhaps have some sort of, in the case of other viruses, and this is a viroid, so it's a little bit different. Only plants get viroids, and they're basically very small viruses. They're viruses, they're RNA viruses in particular, if you can think of it like that, without the protein coding that a lot of viruses have, the capsid. And so they're very, very simple little strands of RNA, essentially, but they can cause you some problems. So in a commercial setting, what you would do is you would have somebody, you would sample them, and then you would send off the tissues to be analyzed or something to this effect. But in a residential space, I don't feel like that's a very common or very possible way for most people to do it. There's no real conventional way that I'm familiar with anyways that's like economical. So that's why I think that it will probably continue to be a massive problem because of the black market, because of traditional markets, however you'd like to say it. You know, the markets that allowed prohibitionary measures to be revealed, you know, don't get me wrong. But because of this, you know, and because people just didn't know any better, you know, I think that it's quite present in a lot of places and people just aren't aware. And the longer cannabis is unsupported by larger institutions, by governments and things like that, the harder it's going to be for people and the more entrenched it's going to become in residential spaces.
Yeah, that's interesting. So in the smaller spaces, what would one do should they suspect they've got this viroid?
Unfortunately, the answer I can only give is probably to cull the plants that you think have it. And unfortunately, because of the way hop latent viroid spreads, primarily through like either equipment, like through shears that you might be using to make cuttings, which again, part of that etiquette I'm talking about, people can't even do because they can't tell that their mother plants or whatever might already be infected. But the other thing is that even leaf touching might be a way that the plants can infect each other because it's mechanical, which is not typical. Not a lot of pathogens are so virulent, but hop latent viroid is one of those really virulent and pernicious pests.
So you would talk, say someone's in a tent, they would have to dispose of that tent potentially. Is that correct?
Yeah, and you might not even want to breed with the plant because although the research is a little bit contentious and I'd like to see more cannabis-specific research come out, hop latent viroid in some cases, laboratory cases, a vertical transmission from parent to offspring has been confirmed, or at least maybe like around maybe 8 to 12%, if I'm remembering the research correctly, and I can send you the research report so that you can add that to a description or something if people are curious about that info. Because it's really important. It's really important for me that people don't just take my word for it and that people are constantly searching for that information themselves to keep up to date.
That's awesome. So when you rock up to a facility, what's the first place you ask to see? So I understand you guys in IPM, you have a method behind what you do. And I believe there's a typical starting point for you guys when you arrive at a facility, and then a place where you potentially hope to finish your research and your data gathering. So where do you ask to start your tour of a facility?
Well, that's very careful that you said it that way, because the first thing that I do is I try to recon the area without being there. Cool. I try to find out what the place looks like on a map. I try to find, and I usually interview a client and ask them, you know, where are you located? Are you located near other grows, especially in the case of cannabis, because there are several cannabis specific pests that they'd have to worry about then as a biosecurity risk, that kind of a thing. When I get to the location, though, the first place that I like to look is the property area around it, partly to confirm that what I was looking at and what I was talking to the person about was the case, but also because in my experience, a lot of people don't control the property outside. And I'm not saying stuff that's outside of their bounds of control, but the things that are inside, their grounds, essentially. You might have like some feral weeds and things like that that can host pests, for example, or pathogens, insects, mice, that sort of a thing.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Are you able to tell me if you've ever seen a pest-free crop?
Definitely. As far as I was able to tell, it has definitely happened. But, you know, rarely do you have nothing wrong, or at the very least, rarely do you not have at least something that could be kind of waiting on the eaves, like I said, in the grounds or something like that. And sometimes people get incidental insects walking around on their plants. Maybe they're not even herbivorous, but they're little bugs and things like that. And people should be careful to not consider those things as a threat. I get asked the most actually about things that are not a pest, which are usually soil predatory mites and springtails, if you've ever heard of those. And so, you know, people will see these, especially when they haven't grown before, as I'm sure you're well aware, and they'll misattribute those as pests, and they'll freak out, and they'll spend a lot of money and a lot of time worrying, which is really unfortunate to me, because they're not really a problem in the vast majority of cases.
Okay, so you mentioned cannabis specific pests, and you say there are a few specific to the cannabis space. Are you able to tell us what those are typically? I'm sure there's a lot to mention, but the most common ones, and what they do to our plant.
Absolutely. So there's two main ones, and maybe those are actually the only two currently known. Now they wreck my brain. The first one is the cannabis aphid, Foradon cannabis. As far as we know, doesn't feed on any other plant but cannabis, and it's closely related to Foradon humuli, which is the damson hop aphid, an aphid that switches between hops, which is the closest relative of cannabis, and prunus species, like almonds and nectarines and things like that. So that's one. The other one is the hemp russet mite, Aculops cannabicola.
And how do they attack the cannabis plant?
So the cannabis aphid, like lots of aphids, its main thing is that a winged female will find a cannabis plant. It will identify it using its eyes and using, you know, by taste and this sort of a thing, by feeding on it. It's a suitable host. And most aphids are born pregnant and they reproduce with clonal offspring. So this female doesn't need to mate or do anything of the sort. All it needs to do is pump out nymphs. And those nymphs will take maybe less than a week in optimal conditions to become adults, that they themselves will then produce more and more nymphal females. And then that colony will grow and grow and grow. And it'll just suck the sap out of the plant. That's what they feed on, is the phloem sap. They love the sugars. They'll probably feed like whole body weights full of sugar every day. And wow. If you're not careful, they'll just exsanguinate the plant.
So you mentioned aphids and nymphs, and I believe I've heard you say that the nymphs are born pregnant. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So what challenges does that bring with regards to controlling the pest? Does it make it more challenging in breaking the cycle?
In a lot of ways, yeah. There are several pests of cannabis and other plants. Well, aphids are a big thing. Aphids in particular account for, I think, the most common insect group that vectors viruses, for example. So we don't know any for cannabis in particular, but like they are a huge problem. And that is part of the problem is that some of these aphids, when they produce so many nymphs, they uptake pathogens like viruses and then they spread them very quickly. In the case for cannabis, the problem arises that if you just let one get away and become a female, then the colony can restart. And so the main issue is that even if people select the right botanical insecticide or biocontrol agent, but particularly the former, if they don't get coverage when they're applying, then you don't really solve the problem. You might beat back the problem very, very far, but they don't have sort of a reproductive bottleneck.
Yeah, okay. So with aphids, do they typically target a plant in veg, or will they go through any cycle of the plant's life?
That's a really good question. They'll go after any and all stages of the plant.
Okay, and is it true that the flowering room typically has is more abundant in pests? Is that in your experience? Is that what you've found? The flowering room has a higher level of pests than the veg room or the mother room in a lot of cases?
I feel like that's often the case, especially with people who do know what they're doing and have a pretty competent IPM regimen or strategy, because you can do less in flower in general. So it's more likely, and you're not going to use some of the same things that you would use in veg in flower. So I think that's generally true, particularly with people who are abreast of the situation.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I guess the plants, when they're in late flower particularly, are typically being pushed a little more by the grower, which might make them a little more susceptible to external, attacks or something along those lines.
Yeah, and the plant's getting older, right? The immune system is different. People don't, I think, often appreciate this, but when a plant is so old or much older, especially if you re-veg or do things like this, the plant is senescing. And, you know, just like when people senesce or other things senesce, they get old and their immune system doesn't work in the same way. Maybe not poorly, but you're right. They are stressed. They're going through a big physiological change.
Fascinating. Dipping. Are you able to tell me a little bit about the practice of dipping? If you've seen a lot of it, if you recommend it, what is the process and the efficacy of it?
So dipping, so either your root dipping or your foliar dipping, especially for like cuttings and seedlings, and maybe not seedlings so much, but plants with a few more leaves in the seedling, it's really helpful, and it isn't very expensive. It's very economical to do this. And the reason why it works so well is for the reason I mentioned earlier. You get a ton of coverage, and it's a lot easier to do when the plant's younger. So it's a great way to give a younger plant or a cutting in particular a much better like protective barrier, so that when it hardens off or when it gets exposed to, you know, the grow cultivation space, whether it's indoor or outdoor, maybe you can do a little bit better. And that's also very true, especially for using like entomopathogenic fungi. Like I love to use Buveria bassiana and things like this, and so the conidia and propagules and things like this, they'll be on the plant for a period of time, and then if an insect comes in and feeds on it, it'll get some of those propagules and hopefully it'll kill it. So you can not only will you have like maybe repellents, but you'll also have maybe a kill, and you'll keep that insect from going on and mating or doing something else.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Is it a practice that's been in agriculture for a long period of time, or is this something that's sort of coming about more recently?
Could you? I didn't understand the question.
The practice, the actual practice of dipping, is it something that's been utilized in agriculture over a long period of time, or is this something that, that's a relatively new practice that, that people are engaging in?
Oh, I see. You know, I probably don't know enough about, although I do like to study various aspects of human agriculture and development. I think that dipping as we think of it is a more modern or perhaps contemporary practice, at least with the substances that we're using, though I am a big fan of dipping with micronized sulfur, and sulfur is one of the oldest pesticides in human history.
Wow, that's really interesting. With regards to probiotics, you see a few probiotic, I guess, products creeping up on shelves in grocery stores. And I just wanted to ask what your thoughts are on probiotics, both as far as a spray for the air, or a spray for the plant, for the leaf tissue and stuff. Do you believe in the probiotics that are out there at the moment, or do you think they're a waste of money?
So probiotic generally implies that, or at least in a microbiological context that I'm familiar with, it implies that the microbe can survive the like feeding process and like the, you know, all the gustatory processes for like humans, for example. Of course, plants are a little bit different. But generally the microbiome is something I'm very interested in. In fact, I recently wrote an article for Skunk Magazine about the cannabis microbiome, and I have videos on my YouTube channel that go over cannabis ecology and, pest host relationships and evolution. And I do like to sort of mention that the cannabis microbiome is not very well understood. And in some of the more recent research, which I am somewhat contentious about, I think that it's probably more unclear than clear about exactly which microbes interact with cannabis. A lot of times things in plants in general like this are kind of species specific. There's a lot of genetic effects that are important.
Yeah, I've actually read that article that you wrote in Skunk Magazine, and I want to mention your input into Skunk Magazine, actually, because you put a heap of great content out there for those guys. So something I didn't mention at the start of the podcast for our listeners, that Matthew also is a very valuable contributor to Skunk Magazine, and there's a heap of really pertinent information in there. So yeah, congratulations in what you're doing on that front as well. Man, you must be busy.
I definitely am, and I'm sure there'll be more busy in the future.
Let's hope so, man. Ladybirds, they're a fairly contentious one. I want to get into the predatory sort of aspect of what you do, but I want to start with ladybirds because some people really, really value them, and other people say they prefer to use other methods typically.
There are a bunch of species of lady beetles that I'm interested in and that I use in IPM context. A lot of people are most familiar with the ones that go after aphids in particular, but there are those that go after spider mites like Stethoris punctillum or whitefly like Dilphasis catalini. But when it comes to aphid feeding lady beetles, there is the harlequin lady beetle, which is Harmonia axyridis, and it is an invasive exotic in North America. It not only feeds on native lady beetles as a intra-guild predation, which is sort of unfortunate, but it also can vector pathogens to the native species as well, which is kind of a ecological concern for me personally. They also can bite people, and they excrete sort of a noxious, smelly substance when they're disturbed. So not maybe something I would use in cannabis particularly. There are other lady beetles you can get, which can be destructively sort of wild harvested, which I also don't, advocate for because of the ecological concerns. But those ones are at least not these invasives. Like at least in North America, we've got the seven spot lady beetle. We've got the convergent lady beetle. And a bunch of other ones. There's even a lady beetle that feeds on powdery mildew called Psyllobora. Vigan maticulata. I think I've got that name right. Might have added or subtracted a syllable there, but Psilobora is the genus.
Yeah, you mentioned the native aspect of the beetles in one place, but I guess predatory mites as a whole, how important is it that we introduce native predators to the grow space in an ecological sense? Because I know here in Australia we've had a couple of massive failures in our agriculture in the past century, and I think one thing that people really need to understand is the effect that bringing in a predator from an external environment that's perhaps not native to your area, how much damage they can cause if you get it wrong.
I am very familiar with several situations in Australia, as well as New Zealand, for that matter. No, absolutely. We definitely learn about it. And I think it's an incredibly important thing that people should be made aware of. It's one of the reasons why I might not be such a cat person, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably currently the biggest problem we've got right now. I guess the old cane toad was a classic as well on our behalf.
Yeah, definitely.
Yes. And that all started with a beetle as well, I believe. I think it started with a beetle that was brought in as a predatory beetle.
I think that was part of the chain, maybe.
Yeah.
I think you might be.
Yeah. And then to get control of the predatory beetle that they introduced, they had to introduce this toad, which now runs rampant and is highly toxic. It's, I guess, to the listener, be careful just bringing in packages of things from other areas because you don't know what effect that could have on your local area.
I will say that because of it, though, Australia and New Zealand and some other island, Hawaii is a great example in the U.S. You guys are very strident and strict about the things that you put in. And in some cases, I have to agree. I'm kind of happy that you guys have that sort of biosecurity model kind of figured out. But to answer your question about predatory mites in particular, I can't really speak to the entirety of the ecological problem potential there. It is something I've thought about a lot, though. I do find that, at least for some of the predatory mites like Swirsii and Cucumerus, and maybe also for Persimilis, because the spider mite, the two-spotted spider mite, and other spider mites are often also kind of, whether because of us or because of other reasons, we're not sure, sort of invasive. I suppose it's kind of like the cane toad situation, but it's kind of hard to tell one predatory mite from another without doing like genetic sequencing and sort of like that. So it's kind of unclear if they're cosmopolitan like their prey are or not. It's just unclear.
Yeah, that's fascinating. You mentioned the two-spotted spider mite, so I'd love to ask about that one because it's something that's very prominent in the cannabis space, something that's spoken about a lot. Are you able to tell us about how this predator or this pest gets into the crop, how you identify it, and what your typical approach should be if you spot it?
For almost all pests, I would say that the most typical way that they get into the crop is through, and especially for the really small ones like spider mites, through people. Either they're on equipment or they're on cuttings like we spoke about earlier, and then they get vectored through human transport, and especially in nurseries or in larger groups when it can be very hard to find a needle in the haystack. Even if they have really competent IPM protocols involved, through transport, who knows, maybe a truck stops at one location or another and somebody's helping to dismount the plants, or maybe some of the farm staff come up to help and then they vector the path, it can happen, pathogens and pests for that matter. But I would say in a natural setting, people get it through the air a lot of the time. The spider mites will make a lot of webbing when they reach a certain population threshold. And when that happens, some of them are sort of behaviorally inclined to make little silken balls. And then like spiders do and spiderlings do, they let out threads of silk and they aggregate And then they fly off into the air because the silk will catch the, or the air will catch the silk, which is quite light, and it will rise them up and make them move out. And they won't like necessarily travel a large distance, maybe several meters. It just depends on how fast the wind is blowing. But you figure in like a non-cultivation setting, maybe like right outside your boundaries of your growing, maybe there's a ton of spider mites on a bunch of plants, and maybe the leaves dry up or something like this, and then they start to web, and then they, you know, get blown out, and they blow near your area, and there's a couple of weeds, and then they establish on the weeds, and then they crawl around, and then they get to your crop. I would say that's a pretty common way to get spider mites. And then to deal with them, I like to apply predatory mites like we discussed, particularly persimilis, because it's a specialist of spider mites, and I find that it works really well. I did earlier mention a lady beetle that goes after spider mites, Sothoris punctillum, which may or may not be accessible to certain people in certain places. Again, like you say, Australia can be strict, and perhaps for good reason, you know?
Yeah, that's really cool. I have a friend who has an insect farm. They sell insects to pet shops, reptile stores, places like this. Now they currently have an issue with their mealworms, and it's an interesting one where they've had a couple of entomologists come in and have a look, and they're yet to solve the problem. I just wanted to quickly chat with you about that. I don't know anything about their facility, to be honest with you, but they have an issue with their mealworms where I believe they get into adolescence, and then 90% of their population dies off within a space of a couple of days. Do you have any ideas of what could occur to make that happen?
Yeah, the first thing that comes to my mind with that description, and when you say inter-adolescence, I assume you mean maybe like, so are they still larvae or maybe pupa?
I think they're pupa, yes.
Yeah. So I would imagine it sounds like a pathogen. It sounds like, because usually when you're rearing these mealworms together, you probably don't even have to tell me, they're probably en masse. They probably don't have their own little, you know, cubicle that they're putting the mealworm into. It's probably large, you know, swaths of the things, which is not wrong to do. This is how everyone does it pretty much. So that's not an issue probably, but yeah, pathogens can just run roughshod through a colony like that. And it's one of the reasons why when people ask me like, hey, can I do like the insectary work myself, which honestly very ambitious and super entrepreneurial. I've probably been asked this question about 100 times. And I actually do agree that there are some ways that you can rear certain biocontrol agents around you kind of helpfully in a way that would actually matter and be helpful. But some of these small predatory mites and things, you don't have the technical ability, you don't have the equipment to do it properly. Moving to your mealworm problem, though, that's kind of why I brought that up, because it's possible that there might just be a simple sanitation issue. Maybe the culture that they're getting is getting contaminated somehow. Maybe before, you know, from the input, maybe the input's contaminated. Yep. Maybe something happens in the interim. And pupae in particular are kind of like you say, sort of inter-adolescent and kind of a vulnerable position for them. And especially perhaps when the pupa is being cast away, and the beetle is eclosing out, and it's tenural, and it's very white, and it doesn't have any of the hardening or anything like that, the chitin. That's when it's most vulnerable, both to predation and in this case to infection. So I think that's the first thing that comes out to my mind. I would imagine it can't be much. There can't probably isn't anything else with that kind of a rate and that kind of a quickness.
Yeah, sure. Now with regards to insect farms, and you're starting to see frass become more popular out there in the marketplace, and I would assume you're going to start seeing more facilities being built with the goal of harvesting insect frass. Can you tell us a little bit about what you know about FRAS and its application to say a cannabis crop, how effective it can be.
Yeah, absolutely. So the main reason that I'm familiar with FRAS being really useful and really helpful to people is because it contains the chitin I was talking about earlier. Chitin is a natural polymer that makes up the much of the exoskeleton of insects and mites, but also the cell walls of fungi. And the reason why it's so helpful as an immune response elicitor is because the plant immune system has evolved to recognize chitin as a no-no, as a problem. If there's chitin that it can detect, that means that there's like the mouth part of an insect in, inside the tissues, or it means that a fungus has gotten in. Even beneficial fungi, being fungi, will have chitin and can elicit an immune response. But in some ways, that might be beneficial and desirable, because if you're controlling it, if you're priming the immune system, so to speak, which doesn't last forever, you know. So this is sort of a constant dance that the physiology is committing to. Then the logic is that if you've already got the immune system primed, then if there is a problem, then that immune system can attack much more readily.
Yeah, okay, that's really interesting. I want to touch on some questions that I've received from some of our followers and listeners, and see if you can't help these guys out with their questions. The first one is Space Dog off Instagram. And he would like to ask, how do you convince your bosses to use lacewing larvae and predatory mites for aphids instead of ladybugs?
I feel like I have a responsibility to answer this question well. So there's a few ways that you can do it. I have found that some people will just not care. And that's just something you might have to accept on the onset. However, I find that the best way to do it, and the one that has the most success, even though I don't like to do it all the often, is you have to kind of attack the wallet. You have to explain that it's probably more expensive to use one thing over the other, potentially. In some cases, it's not. A lot of times you can get lady beetles from third hand in areas, not even insectaries. Distributors, and they might be less expensive, but you know, what do they say? Like, there's nothing more expensive than a cheap tool. You kind of get what you pay for, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
I think that's a really important thing to sort of hammer on. And if people are already buying biocontrols like this and not having an effect, then, you know, give them that analogy. That is very true. In my experience, that's the case. You want to get things from the insectary proper. You don't want to get them from third hand distributors usually. And for lacewings in particular, they're super voracious. And I guess you could watch some of my videos and maybe point them in the right direction there too.
Very cool. Very cool. That's well done, man. Next one is Pugmelon. Pugmelon would like to ask, what's the best way to deal with fungus gnats, whether it being a natural holistic approach or also dealing with them through a pesticide or even through predatory bugs? What would you recommend?
I'm very partial to using the Buveria bassiana fungus that I mentioned earlier as a soil or a substrate drench, depending on how you're growing and everything like that. But I've had the most efficient response with nematodes, Steinernema felciae or SF nematodes that people can encounter in most places that sell them. They're really great for fungus gnats, like the dark winged fungus gnats people get. I think they also work really well on shore flies too, which are really common in Europe as well as North America.
That's awesome. And one from Oz CNC guy, longtime listener of ours, quite an active follower. So he'd like to know, he'd love some input on organic whitefly controls.
Ooh, good question. And a very good question, especially for cannabis. See, the silverleaf whitefly, Bemisia tabaci, is a vector for the lettuce chlorosis virus, which has recently been found in cannabis and is lethal. There's no conventional way to deal with it, kind of like hop latent viroid. And you can check out the symptoms of that on my YouTube channel as well, and also for silverleaf whitefly for some controls. But to answer your question here, and I'm happy to help out a longtime viewer, the Buveri bassiana that I mentioned is really great. It works really well. In fact, it's the thing that I cut my teeth on. It's the pest I cut my teeth on with Buveri bassiana. And it worked very effectively because they like to stay in one colony and they don't like the light and they like to stay on the bottom of the leaves. So you just get that coverage and it'll infect the entire colony.
That's awesome. There you go, Oz CNC guy. You've heard it from the man himself, so get on to it. And thank you for your loyalty as well, man. Now, from Ferris, six-year-old child here in Perth, Western Australia, he might actually get to listen to this little cut of Daddy's podcast as well. He'd like to know, he's heard that some spiders have pets, so his exact question is, do spiders have pets?
Oh, I've seen the articles about this kind of a thing. So it's kind of true. It's sort of a mutualism. It's a symbiosis. It's kind of, maybe they don't really consider themselves master and pet or anything like that, but in a way they're more like friends. They're more like coworkers, maybe, which might even be cooler.
That's really cool. And next thing you would like to know is, exactly how do spiders climb vertically on walls, on water fountains, things like this? How do they do it?
Oh, yeah. So a lot of spiders have they have hooks, tarsals. So the last joint in an arthropod leg. So arthropod means armored leg. So the last hook is the tarsal hook. They have the tarsus and the tarsal hook, and that's what they use to kind of scale. And some spiders have like pads on their feet that have a pattern to them that kind of allows them to, like, it's like jimping on a knife, which is kind of a weird example, I suppose, but it allows them to like kind of get this sort of grit and they can hold fast.
That's awesome, man. And then the last one. This is for something I've been fascinated by. I don't know really anything about it, and it's hard to find people that can explain it. Now, I did sort of mention it to you a good few weeks ago. Fasciation and diploidy. My understanding is they can commonly present in a similar fashion, but they are not the same thing. Are you able to give the layman such as myself that doesn't have a degree in biology or anything like that a bit of an understanding of what fasciation is and what diploidy is and how they differ?
Absolutely. So fasciation is when the some aspect of the plant's physiology, usually the stem, but also the floral architecture, it's a mutation essentially. And so some people actually associate fasciation with like polyploidy or some sort of difference in ploidy than is the norm, in a plant. And that sometimes can be the case. Sometimes fasciation can be caused by this. Other times it's just what we call a sport mutation, just happens to happen that way. And it's usually because of some sort of, not only is it genetic change, but also there's a hormonal thing involved, which is causing the stem to sort of be like this flat kind of shape instead of being like a circular stem. And so it's a hormonal thing ultimately that's happening. And in regards to ploidy, it's because there's a different set of chromosomes, which is of course going to change the amount of genes and how they interact.
Yeah, fascinating. So if someone were in the field and they were to spot, say, a flower, which you mentioned the flatness perhaps, or perhaps it looks like a double flower or something along those lines, is there any way that the layman can differentiate between what's going on there, or you're just sort of guessing?
Oh, usually if it's got that like flattening or like multiple head mutation kind of associated with fasciation, it's not necessarily, you can't possibly know if it's something that's a heritable trait or not. For example, if it's due to like a chromosome count being different.
Very good. Very good. Now you're an insect guy. You love insects, right? You've been into them through your childhood, through your whole life. Your job is based around them, amongst other things. Is there anything conflicted in you, Matthew, that you love insects, but you're going to battle with them at the same time? How do you feel about that?
Yeah, there's this great Saturday morning breakfast cereal comic. For those who don't know, a lot of people know SMBC comics or whatever, but they there's this great comic where it says, it's like the punchline is biologists are weird, and it's a picture of a professor and a student, and the professor saying, "Oh, you love insects? Oh, great! That's what you'll be spending killing for the next 30 years, or something to that effect." And it resonated with me for obvious reasons. It is a bit of a conflict. I think I take the most, I guess you could say, pleasure in the fact that at least in a lot of cases, these are invasives and that I am protecting resources for people,
yeah.
Which has a certain level of nobility to it, I suppose. But ultimately, I do kind of feel like it's unfortunate in some cases that we have to kill particularly native species. I do take my identification work seriously though, and that's why I'm very interested in like technologies where like what's called the photonic fence, which is like a radar and laser system, which sounds really sci-fi and cool. I was able to discriminate moths and other insects from mosquitoes, and it was used as it was proposed as an anti-malaria sort of system. And I thought that was really cool. And it would be really great if we could find other ways where we don't have to kill, as broadly as some cases we do.
That's cool. Now, at the start of the podcast, you mentioned, the fantasy aspect of certain things in your childhood. And I see some of that creeping in with your content now. I can see you're quite clearly into some of these fantasy worlds, and you apply it to what you do with regards to IPM. I think it's awesome, man. I really congratulate you on the way you approach this and the way you put yourself out there, and you let a little bit of your character come through in what you do. And it takes me to a friend named Jeff Lowenfeld who wrote a book, Teaming with Microbes, and then he went on with further books, further publications beyond that. And his concept was to present a real world battlefield or scenario in regards to the soil food web to help people visualize and understand the biology and what he's talking about. And I can see an element of that in what you're doing. And I think it's awesome because it does help people understand a little better about this battle and this sort of environment that's going on, and try and I guess they can empathize with it a little better when it's not just pure science talk. So I do congratulate you on the way you go about things, Matthew. And I see really good things coming for you, man, because you're unique. You're a great character for the industry. And I really thank you for coming and joining us on the podcast. It's been a pleasure, man. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And I really appreciate the compliment.
Thank you very much, man. And I look forward to perhaps down the track another interview with you, if that'd be doable. Because I really enjoy chatting with you, man, and look forward to seeing what you put out there from here.
Well, thanks. I hope the character becomes richer and more interesting. I appreciate that.
Cheers, man. Thank you very much for joining us, Matthew. And guys, if you're listening, check him out. Xenthanol, Sink Angel. Check out his content at Skunk Magazine. Matthew Gates, he's the entomologist, or the IPM specialist, sorry, shall I say, that you really want to follow, because he's putting all the good stuff out there. Thank you very much, Matthew.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Canter. Any guest views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the guests and not necessarily those of the hosts. Canter strongly suggests listeners research local, state, and federal laws and regulations before conducting any cannabis-related activity.